Today's great life died so recently it's hard to believe he's really gone. He was a manager and a musician and so many things besides that categorising Malcolm McLaren is not really something I think we should even try to do. Instead, I'm going to read a press release used to publicise a one-man show he presented in Edinburgh only last year. "I've been called many things," McLaren wrote, "a charlatan, a con man, or the culprit responsible for turning popular culture into nothing more than a cheap marketing gimmick. This is my chance to prove these accusations are true." Time now to hear the voice of the man himself.
I went out to sell Johnny Rotten as someone who couldn't sing and a band that couldn't play. And I've never, ever really worked with professionals. Constantly I've worked with amateurs because they're much easier to manipulate, to be honest, and get to do what you want them to do. More able to be spontaneous, and you can induce in them, I think this is why I've been always considered a bit of a manipulator, you can tell them a story and make them behave in a way that you want. You can emotionally build them up.
You need hands to hold someone you care.
And I bet you thought we'd play something by the Sex Pistols.
To show that you're sincere when you feel nobody wants to know you.
Malcolm McLaren singing the Max Bygraves classic, You Need Hands. My guest, who's chosen McLaren, is no stranger to the unpredictable art of publicity. Mark Borkowski has handled PR for film stars, comedians, TV shows, circuses. The list is endless and stretches from Diego Maradona to Sir Cliff Richard and Eddie Izzard. Is there anyone who can't be helped by the Borkowski effect? Well, why not make that a real rather than a rhetorical question? What sort of client would you turn away, Mark?
I think in this day and age, you do have to look at yourself in the mirror and think about the principles of the brand. And I have not taken some of the more dodgier ends of the industry, big pharma, tobacco, because you have to, in some way, project their values.
It's the old trilogy, isn't it? Get on, get honest, and then get honour. You've reached the get honour phase.
I don't think I've ever changed my values in terms of what I want to represent. And I perhaps have been more attracted to the maverick and the more interesting rather than the corporates with something to hide.
You've half answered my next question, but I'll ask it anyway. Why have you chosen Malcolm McLaren?
I don't think I'd be sitting here as a publicist now if I had not been influenced in some way, particularly in a very early part of my life, by the Malcolm McLaren effect. I was fascinated by him, and where many of my friends were picking up a guitar and perhaps had visions of becoming the next Johnny Thunders, I was more interested in the people behind the scenes, perhaps pulling the strings.
Many say he was cold. A few would doubt that he was exploitative. Are these things you admired?
In an age where we know everything and we can, by the flick of a switch, the press of a keyboard, we can get an answer, I don't think we'll ever get close to a true understanding of who he is. And that's what I'm fascinated in. I'm fascinated in those people who can spin those myths, who can engage in those stories, who can shift people's concepts of their everyday life. I remember being in a small theatre in Swindon and watching an entire audience laugh at a piece of theatre. And the connection with that, where I felt I had some small part in bringing that audience to enjoy that piece of theatre. And whatever was going on in their life, whatever their problems, whatever, for that two-hour experience, they'd forgotten about it all because it was brilliant and it transformed them. And I think partly the art of the publicist throughout history, and maybe this is a terribly romantic, bucolic view of this, have the ability for people to forget for a second.
It may be impossible to get to who the man really was, but let's try. And to help us, we have the author, Chris Salovich, who was a features writer on the New Musical Express between 74 and 81, just at the time Malcolm McLaren was rewriting the book on how to manage a band. And I'm told that you, Chris, told someone from EMI to go and see the Sex Pistols when they were playing to just a handful of people because it would change their lives. Is that true?
Yes, it was someone from EMI Publishing, and he did actually sign the Sex Pistols as a consequence. And I'd seen them play at the Nashville Rooms in West London. Actually, I wasn't really judging them on musical merit at that point, because that was the show when Vivian Westwood, the partner of Malcolm McLaren, seemed to be having a fight with a member of the audience. And then Johnny Rotten leaps down into the audience and is also having a fight with this person. And I didn't even see Malcolm at that gig. I had already seen him. I'd come across him, in fact, with the journalist Nick Kent.
And you knew that he was a force behind the Sex Pistols, did you, at that stage?
I did at that stage already, but I didn't know... Malcolm knew nothing about music whatsoever.
Just from the start, describe his appearance.
He's sort of ginger hair, and there's something kind of slightly etiolated about him. It's quite hard to actually pin down what he precisely what he looks like. Certainly Faye, certainly, I mean, almost undernourished, actually. I mean, he kind of looks like someone who's, as he was born in 1946, he almost looks like a war baby.
He was bewitching. He talked and talked. He had a sort of odd voice, a sort of whiny sort of voice and so on. But he just caught you. I mean, the subject matter, it was very difficult to shut him up.
I was a manager, but I was a spokesman. I was a creator. I was a character that they denied being an artist. That couldn't do that. But when you produced the group, your name always preceded it. And I kept saying to the group, and I kept saying to the record company, you know, the reason I can't sell this group is because I am constantly bigger than the group.
I mean, I don't think there was anyone else, really, in Malcolm's world, actually, apart from himself. And I remember seeing Malcolm give one of his talks that he gave. This was probably about 6 years ago. And it amazed me that everyone else had been written out of the story. There was no Vivian Westwood, there was no Bernie Rose, the manager of The Clash, who actually discovered Johnny Rotten. There was no one in that story, really, apart from Malcolm.
How does this apparently confident, apparently self-possessed person emerge from what we know about the childhood that he had? Tell us a little bit about that. It was pretty remarkable.
His parents split up, and in fact, when he did a programme, a TV programme in, I think it was 1992, for Channel 4 about Oxford Street, in which he revealed that his mother had had an affair with Charles Claw, who owned Selfridges, his parents split up, and he went to live with his grandmother, who was the family was were in jewellery.
There were harsher rumours about his mother than that she'd had an affair, weren't there?
Well, there were rumours of prostitution, but I mean, whether you know this was true or not, I don't know. And there is also a story that once they found themselves sitting opposite to each other on a tube train, and they just looked at each other and didn't speak, and at their respective stops left.
But this is beautiful, isn't it? I mean, here we are, you know, talking about this web of mythology.
Yeah.
The person who really has the ultimate story is the person not here any longer.
It's easy, though, isn't it? Once you know what kind of a man was, in this case, pretty anarchic, pretty strange, sometimes quite withdrawn, it's easy then to link it to things that we know about the childhood. But there was also this primitive, overriding desire to make a splash, both in McLaren's case, and I would suggest in yours, professionally, you've always wanted to make a splash. Did you as a little boy want to make a splash? What makes a man want to make a splash all the time?
I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know. I'm jumping in the water. And let's draw culturally into thinking about McLaren. McLaren comes from a rich vein of managers, manipulators, whatever you want to call them. You know, Colonel Parker with Elvis, Gordon Mills with Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones. I mean, Gordon Mills created those two icons. You know, they were much as good-looking guys. And, of course, you have Brian Epstein. Every generation has thrown these people up who absolutely understand the power they're playing with.
But I don't think that Colonel Tom Parker or Gordon Mills thought of themselves as artists, and I think that's the difference with Malcolm. And Malcolm, you know, who went to Croydon Art School, he certainly saw himself as an artist, and interestingly, actually, was therefore possibly more amoral than either of those characters. I mean, Malcolm's
more immoral than Colonel Parker. had ultimate control over Elvis. Peter Grant?
I would say that he had more control over Sid than Colonel Tom Parker had over
Vicious.
Elvis. In fact. Yeah, Sid Vicious.
Really. Tell us a bit, Chris, about this early phase in McLaren's life. You said he went to art school. What did he do there?
Well, he studied painting, but his real interests in were situationism, which was, you know, the rebellions in Paris in 1968.
What is situationism?
Well, it's actually very amorphous, and it just seems to be actually creating as much trouble as possible through the use of slogans and sort of surrealism, in fact. Malcolm kind of specialised in slogans like, you know, provocation is oxygen, for example. Hence the names of his shops, you know, Too Fast to Live, Too Young to Die, Seditionaries, I mean, very basically Sex, which at the time, the shop called Sex was extremely confusing, in fact. It seems now, it was called Sex. No, at the time, it was rather baffling why a shop could be called that. But really, as a friend of mine, Joe Stevens, who was a photographer on the NME, said, the thing about Malcolm is, once a haberdasher, always a haberdasher. And he became a fashion designer early in the 1970s, and that's really how his career began. And out of that, he discovered the New York Dolls, came into the shop one day, and I think it's 1972, ended up managing them in 1975 in New York, giving them this Maoist look, which was completely absurd and would never do anything in America, obviously.
Yeah, he'd gone to the States, and he'd been immensely inspired by Andy Warhol, who not only produced art but also had a band, then found himself involved with, as you say, the Dolls, this early punk band. Here he is talking about this time.
My one contribution was to create a hammer and sickle flag at the back of the stage. I dressed them all in red vinyl. I gave them the slogan, Better Red Than Dead. What are the politics of boredom? All the things I thought that added up to the idea of the rebel culture. And here I was taking the darlings of downtown Manhattan and turning them into little red Maoists. Well, the journalists hated me.
Strange voice, Mark. It's something a bit gay about it. What, was he gay?
No, Mark wasn't gay, but it's mesmerising. It's mesmerising. It's like that scene from The Jungle Book when you're looking at the snake. Eyes ago. It's hypnotic. Yeah. Go back to Chris's point here about the haberdasher. P.T. Barnum was a haberdasher, and that's because you have a close idea of your customers. By understanding the people who turn up to your shop, you start to understand what the market is. He understood exactly what the people want. And he had a very clever sense at his height and his power, and his powers did wane, of exactly how to provoke. There was an algebraic formula to the way that Malcolm put those pieces together in this little jigsaw to create a virtual story virus. And for all great publicists, there is one thing that existed at the time of the first Telegraph was set, the first yellow journalism, is the captivating narrative. And he understood how that word of mouth would evolve. I've seen it in a number of great promoters.
Chris, I completely agree with what Mark has just said. This sense of the spirit of the age, sense of the zeitgeist, I can remember it because I was a young man at that time. Actually, it turned me into a right-winger because the age was all a bit social democrat. But I remember the attraction of punk to young conservatives like myself. And Boris Johnson, yes. Yes, and John Whittingdale, who's now a government minister with some responsibility for broadcasting. That was the spirit of the age. And McLaren understood it and turned it into something. How are we going to explain it to future ages, though? I struggle even now to explain how it was we all felt.
It cannot be denied that Malcolm McLaren unleashed a cultural change, a cultural earthquake that really came to dominate the last quarter of the 20th century. And it's really that kind of do-it-yourself ethos, the idea that anyone can do anything. And, I mean, that was kind of obviously, you know, you can see that in the sort of, you know, the independent record labels that sprung up, but also in other people working in fashion, other people working in film, even in publishing. He was the catalyst that unleashed all that.
You're listening to The Great Life of Malcolm McLaren, chosen by a man often described as PR guru, Mark Borkowski. Also with us is the author Chris Salovich. As a publicist, Mark, what was it that McLaren did for the Sex Pistols that so impresses you?
He just took it to the limit, and how amazing is it to do a record deal and the signing was outside Buckingham Palace? Just pure genius. It's a simple sort of thought. And if you look at those pictures then of the Bemuse record executive and the Pistols around there, and Malcolm is standing back smirking. There's a sort of triumphalism in that photo opportunity. There wasn't a whole host of sort of flanks of photographers there. There was probably one photographer, but that picture was disseminated. And clearly, the opportunities that arose from the Bill Grundy show, the expletive on the Bill Grundy show, clearly
rude,
wasn't. Yeah. I don't believe Malcolm said, look, you know, come out with something that's going to get us banned. But he seized opportunity where Generation would have tried to cover that up. That fitted so neatly.
But actually, it wasn't really very controversial at all. I watched it at the time. I couldn't understand what the fuss was about at all. But he seemed to know nothing whatsoever about music subsequently. And in conversations with him, you would discover this. But he would say, oh, well, that's not the point. And you would say, well, it's a pity the Pistols broke up in January 1978 when they could have broken America and been a huge act. Oh, no, that's not the point. But you kind of felt, actually, it possibly was the point, and you realised he was just stumbling into everything.
He didn't, Chris, treat his protégés, well, they weren't really protégé, very well. I mean, he didn't treat the Sex Pistols very well, did he?
Well, no, I mean, we've talked about Sid Vicious, who seemed to be allowed to decline into serious heroin addiction almost as an art statement. Glenn Matlock, who wrote the songs, was fired quite early on. A bad move, I think, actually, but not if you were going according to Malcolm's ethos. He created his own mythology about this as well. I mean, for example, he would say that he tried to stop Sid being into junk by removing his girlfriend Nancy Spungen. You know, there's a story that he got her into the boot of a car, took her to the airport. Well, if you think about it, you know, how would you get her on a plane? You know, I mean, it just wouldn't work. So, you know, there is the element of fantasy here all the time. But for example, when he's working with Adam Ant, you know, Adam Ant later becomes a huge star, following really what Malcolm has told him to do. But what he actually does is he gives him advice on what he should do and then steals his backing group to form Bow Wow Wow, which has a 15-year-old singer.
These are the allegations, foremost among them that allegation about Sid Vicious and his girlfriend. Let's hear his own side of that story.
The nature of the group was the fact that they were the Wild Bunch, or at least professed to be, and I could not treat them otherwise. I could see certain things happening and try to stop them. I did try to kidnap Sid Vicious's girlfriend once from her apartment and gagged her and threw her in the back of a truck and gave her a passport and had my assistant drive her to the airport. But she bust out of the back in the middle of George Street in the West End and screamed to a cop that she was being molested and kidnapped by the Sex Pistols manager. Well, we'd only been on the front pages the day before with some drug bust of Sid's. So I fled back to the offices and, you know, Sid we'd kept in a dentist chair that very afternoon, under gas, paid heavily, I might add, by a private dentist. And when he awoke, of course, we knew he was going to scream blue murder, that his girlfriend was being thrown out of the country by none other than myself. And I knew it was going to be very difficult to talk to him thereafter. But he got over it. But you have to go through those experiences if that's what you intend and wish to do.
Or not, as the case may be. Let me lay my cards on the table here, you two. And if you're listening, Malcolm McLaren. I don't think it's clever to con the public. I don't think it's clever to make your fortune out of spinning some hopeless and you think talentless youths, unhappy kids, into the sort of music sensation that has you laughing up your sleeve all the way to the bank, and you actually think that their talentlessness is the story. I don't think it's clever to make a lot of money out of them, screwing them up in the process. I think the Sex Pistols actually had the last laugh on McLaren because they were significant and they did have something to say, and there was something in their music, and the raw energy and the nihilism helped define the age. I thought punk was great, as I was saying, but I don't think this was created by PR, and I'm not quite sure that I like the PR that sustained it. Is that unfair, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's very unfair. I think there isn't enough moralising about PR. But ultimately, all hype is hype. It has to deliver. Nothing expedites the end of a brand if it's rubbish. You can't create something to sell something. The public have an answer for that. The public can make their own decision, more so now than perhaps they did then. Arguably, some of the points you make are right. But there was an innocence then, to a certain extent, that doesn't exist now. And I think from your particular background, you will see a whole different edge to political PR. You've seen a change in that, you know, significantly over the last years. And I've always been very public about talking about the process of making people look and understand the process that goes on.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the problem. You're just more honest than some of the others. And McLaren himself was very honest about what he did. In fact, he was his own most spiteful critic. Where did his career go, Chris, after the Sex Pistols? Because the Sex Pistols by no means the end of Malcolm McLaren's career.
I mean, Malcolm becomes a famous recording artist, in fact. I mean, in 1983, he does his Duck Rock album, and there are two big hits off it, Buffalo Gowers and Double Dutch. And I remember being in New York, wanting to find out the latest hip-hop records, the latest rap records, and being sent to, you know, what was supposedly the best store in Manhattan where I could find these. And what they're recommending to me is the Malcolm McLaren records. And actually, I didn't want to know about those. I knew about those already. But the point about that was that he really, in some ways, he opened up, you know, white America's heads to rap music because he was on MTV. He becomes a film producer, or tries to become a film producer. I mean, he moved to Hollywood for some time, and there was a film I think he wanted to make about Nazi surfers, which actually was, you know, typical Malcolm McLaren. Well, that was obviously never going to get made. He worked on the film Fast Food Nation with the producer Jeremy Thomas, and apparently was considered a complete nightmare on it. There were various jobs. There were various things that he was claimed to be about to do. Like, in 1999, he said he was going to stand as a candidate for mayor of London. Then later he was supposed to be in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Neither of these actually came to anything. And the I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here thing, he dropped out the day before. But you kind of felt that he was never going to do anything with those. Those were just to keep him in the public eye.
He was certainly going to do I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I've talked him out of that.
Really?
Yeah, I talked him out of that in the sense that I had a phone call from his partner at the time and said, who was worried. Malcolm had never seen the programme and was offered a substantial amount of money. I explained to him what they needed him to do, because obviously Johnny Rotten had been in it. And I said, your credibility is your last foundation. What do you want to be remembered for? And they were banging on the door in a hotel in Queensland, was the producer, and he pulled out. And it was incredible then that I think what we're talking about is that Malcolm McLaren, the industry became Malcolm McLaren. It didn't become what Malcolm McLaren was doing. It was the industry of Malcolm McLaren.
But it's interesting that I immediately assumed that this was a stunt, and many other people I know assumed this was a stunt. And you kind of think, oh, typical Malcolm, because it shows how you never quite know where you are with him.
Let's listen to something from this second, final phase of his career. Not his music, but his work as a radio broadcaster.
I'm Malcolm McLaren. And in the many years I've lived in Paris, there have been few places where I haven't found something connected to Serge Gainsbourg. If you walk into some of the ubiquitous department store entertainment emporiums, you're going to see giant cardboard cutout figures of Serge, unshaven, in his pinstripe jacket, blue jeans, a cigarette dangling from his lips. But Gainsbourg was no Maurice Chevalier. He became famous the world over for a heavy breathing hit, many believed, had been made during an actual night of passion. He scandalized French patriots by recording a reggae version of La Marseillaise. Even so, his death in 1991 was mourned throughout France. Quite an achievement for an artist who once declared, "For me, provocation is oxygen."
At his funeral, a letter was read from Steve Jones, which began, "Dear Malcolm, did you take the money with you? Is it in the coffin?" Before going on to say, "You taught me a lot about life." My thanks to Mark Borkowski for choosing Malcolm McLaren as this week's Great Life, and to Chris Salovich as our expert witness. Goodbye.